J. Allen Danilek is the author of Reconsidering Atlantis, a new look at a prehistoric civilization, the mystery of reincarnation, and the case for ghosts, an objective look at the paranormal. He has also written for Fate magazine and is currently pursuing a career as a novelist. The website is www.ourcuriousworld.com. That's our, O-U-R, curious world. .com, no spaces or hyphens or anything like that. Just type it all in, it'll take you there. And Ghostly Talk would like to welcome to the program J. Allen Danilek. Welcome.
Well, hi guys, how you doing?
It's good to have you. You dropped on a long time ago. I'm trying to remember, it was a couple of years
it
ago
was
we had you on.
Years,
yeah,
I think.
And like one of the things I've been doing here towards the end of the year has been I kind of like went through our, you know, all of our past guests we've had over the years and stuff like that, and kind of said, oh, you know, who are the greatest people we had on the show, the people we really had a great time talking to, and you're one of those people that popped up on the list, Jeff, so you're back, isn't it great?
Wow, yeah, and the nightmares are almost over.
There's been a lot's happened since the last time you were on, though. There's a lot to talk about. We know that already. But the one thing, the case for ghosts, you know, and the one thing that really caught my eye on this is an objective look at the paranormal, which I thought was very interesting because it's one of the hard things people have with all the different facets of studying the paranormal. So I was wondering, you know, tell us about this. What's this all about?
Yeah, how can you be objective looking for something that's relatively invisible?
Yeah, it's like looking for oxygen, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, well, I do believe that you have to approach all of these subjects with an open mind, basically.
Mm-hmm.
If you go into it trying to prove what you already believe, chances are that you're going to kind of work the evidence to your favor. If you go into it with the assumption that there's probably something here, but I'm going to wait and see what we find,
mm-hmm.
then I think you you have a little bit better balance in what you're doing. Also, you have to have an openness to it, or else you're not going to even look for these things to begin with.
But the scientific method is observe something and then come up with a hypothesis about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then come up with an experiment to test that hypothesis. So it seems like you should, like, if you're applying a scientific method kind of thing, to if you call this a science, then you should have something in mind as to what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the scientific method, you know, they do go about it with an open mind. You know, my hypothesis is that, you know, a ghost can break a light bulb or uh-huh. something, right? So I design something, and I might find that, no, a ghost can't break a light bulb. I don't know, you know.
You make that happen, dude. You're not going to be doing this show no more.
Yeah, well, I do. Well, my grandmother does it.
Yeah, right? Yeah. There is that thing, yeah.
But I don't, I can't command her to do it, though.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem to work that way. But you should have something in mind, but I imagine you're talking more like you may not passionately believe or vehemently believe something is so. Otherwise, you could skew your own evidence.
Right. Well, I'm thinking back to, like, when Pasteur was investigating germ theory. There was no real evidence for germs up front. He was working from the assumption that there was something out there that was creating sickness. So he was already doing his investigation from the premise that there was something that existed out there.
Okay. I see. Yep.
So the scientific method is not just a matter of observing something and then trying to figure out what happened. It can also work the other way. When you're looking for multiple dimensions in physics, and you have to smash the atoms together and see if any of them disappear and all that kind of thing into an alternative or a parallel universe,
mm-hmm.
you're working from the premise that there's such a thing as a parallel universe.
Interesting. So some of it could be maybe assumptions or something that you're testing,
yeah.
Or ID, you know, I mean, it's an inventive process.
Well, I mean,
we started out
this conversation, you know, which is, I mean, I have to wholeheartedly agree.
Well, we're trying to be objective.
Well, you're trying to be objective, and you're trying to be open-minded also. So
yeah.
That's, you know, in that, developing any type of hypothesis on these things, I mean, yeah, the sky's the limit.
Quite often, the hypothesis precedes the testing. You come up with a hypothesis, is what you think is going to happen, and
yeah.
then you do the testing to see whether it holds up or not.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And that's firm scientific scientific methodology. So in Louis Pasteur, he couldn't see these germs, right?
Mm-hmm.
He didn't even know that they were there. He just had this idea or this hunch that something is there
mm-hmm.
causing these illnesses.
Right. And then as they begin to develop telescopes that had the power to actually see these things, then they had to determine what are these things that we're looking at. You know, what is a bacteria? What does it do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how does it affect our body? So it was more than just an idea that there was such a thing as bacteria. He also had to figure out, he had to work from the premise that they do something to us.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They're not just some inert object inside our body.
So
there was a lot of assumption had to go on before he was able to really do any sort of experimentation.
And I imagine, now that's probably just, and we probably only hear, like, his success story. Like, he might have had some really fanciful ideas that are in his diaries or something, or he told people that we'll never know about, that were just absolutely, like, even if he repeated them to us, we'd be like, ha ha, that's not the way the world
works.
Yeah,
initially he thought that germs that sickness was caused by unicorns.
Right, right.
Yeah,
for example,
he gave up on that.
Well, unicorns still make me pretty sick, to tell you the truth.
Only could kiss them right on the lips.
But you know, another you know thing that just kind of popped in my head as we were discussing this is, you were talking about germs, right, and things like that. You know, and at one time, yeah, we could not see them because we didn't have the tools to see them.
We're pretty much at that point right now with ghosts and
well, that's
a
what
lot
I'm saying,
of supernatural
yeah.
stuff. I mean, a lot of study has gone into ESP and remote viewing and, you know, anything that's had money thrown at it.
Yeah, yeah.
Ghosts don't seem to have very much money thrown at them.
No.
You know, so it's we're pretty much at the same.
Well, what I'm thinking, though, is that, well, yeah, I mean, at that point where you know, like we were just saying, you know, there was no tools at one time to see these microscopic organisms.
Right. And we have no tools to see ghosts.
No, I mean, we think we do. Well, some people think they do.
You know, I was reading, Jeff, I was reading on a blog. Somebody had blogged something that, you know, what's the use of EMF or whatever, EMF detectors, or what's the use of taking photographs, you know, and what's the use of all this stuff? Mm-hmm. And really, I didn't answer it because I started typing the, you know, I didn't postulate an answer to it or whatever it is, because I started typing it out, and then I thought, oh my gosh, this is going on and on and on. No one's going to read, you know, seven paragraphs in response to just a quick question, right?
Yeah.
So, but the thing is I thought that all these tools that we're using, the EMF detectors, the dowsing rods, the temperature gauges, the photographs, the audio recorders, the video recorders, all these things that we're doing, we're pretty much just looking for anomalous occurrences and recording these things that shouldn't be there, and you know, because we don't know that an EVP is actually caused by a ghost.
Well, no, we don't.
We don't know that a vortex is caused by a ghost. We don't know that, you know, any of this stuff is actually caused by a ghost.
All we're doing is collecting information as far as going out there and doing this work or whatever you want to call
unless
it.
Unless somebody has tied, you know, made the connection between a ghost and all this activity that we're trying to record. Do you know of any, Jeff?
Well, what you need to do when you're working with this equipment is you take it in its completeness. You don't take any one part of it. For example, if you're getting high EMF readings in a room and you take a picture and you get some kind of a vortex or even some kind of an apparition, then you're using things together and they reinforce each other.
Right.
And so at that point, that's actually using real science because you are actually looking for changes in the environment or any kind of images that could be caught on different frequencies, infrared, things of this nature. And you're putting all of it together. Now, where it comes, the ghost part comes in when you can get it to be interactive, when you can ask it questions and it has some way of communicating with you.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can start thinking, okay, now I'm dealing with something that's intelligent. It's not just some sort of an energy inversion layer.
Yeah.
So it all adds up. You got to put all the parts together. Then you can start coming up with a premise that I'm dealing with a disembodied consciousness here, which is what we call a ghost.
Well, yeah, and I mean, one of those, I think one of the ties together, like that ties all this together. Hey, nice segue. But one of the things is that we've talked to a few people here in the last few months, as a matter of fact, that have said they've done these EVP sessions, and they were able to get verifiable answers. I mean, again, you see, this is where we're always bouncing back to this objectivity part, because if you read something in the library about some colonel at a place you're going to investigate, right? You go into the place and you do an EVP session. Let's just say, you know, his name was Colonel John or something like that, right, or whatever. And you go, you know, is your name John? And then you hear something on the recording that says, you know,
yes.
You know, I've gotten something, yes, or something like that, you know, or maybe they even, you even hear the word John or something like that. It's still, we're always getting into, I mean, this Matrixing thing is getting worse and worse on all mediums now, it seems, whereas, you know, even with audio, with pictures, I mean, Christ.
Or did you front load the ghost or the disembodied entity?
Well, if they're an intelligent entity, like some people say they are, you could front load them too, it seems like, also.
Well, I mean, there's the trickster spirits that they say inhabit Ouija boards like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, so, I mean, they could easily take on the persona of this Colonel John.
But the thing is like, you know, what I was saying, and I just took myself off my own damn point, was that, I mean, there are people verifying things, you know, via EVP as far as, you know, getting answers, and they're able to verify these things, maybe even, you know, maybe after is what I'd like to hear, is like, you know, he said his name was John, so we went to the library the next day, and sure enough, there's a
somebody
guy
named John. There. Yeah.
But ideally, what you want to hear, you know.
You do have to be careful with hauntings at a fairly well-known locale. Because that does happen, where people are expecting a particular energy to appear.
Yeah.
And so they're already anticipating whatever comes through is going to be what they're looking for. But the cases that I've looked at that were more interesting were people would get into a conversation with something, would identify itself, And then later on, they found evidence that this person actually existed.
Mm-hmm.
Those are pretty compelling pieces of evidence. Additionally, if you did have a trickster ghost, as you like to call it,
mm-hmm.
That also would be useful. Because it would, even if it wasn't really the actual ghost of John, it was still demonstrating that there's paranormal energies out there, intelligent paranormal energies.
Well, yeah, you know, but my thing that, again, what I'm saying concerning EVPs, and, you know, I'm not contesting anybody. I mean, we listen to EVPs all the time here. It's still the matrixing thing. I mean, there's only been, I think, you know, in the last 5 years I've heard, like, as far as EVPs are concerned, where I... You know, and even then, it's still, we have a couple that we think are just absolutely phenomenal, right? I mean, there's no doubt in our minds that these are some type of disembodied spirit that manifested these voices on the tape or the recorder, right?
But are we being objective or subjective?
Yeah, well, I'm hoping that we're being objective. And I mean, there's only a bit,
Well, if you watch her, you guys watch Ghost Hunters, right?
Sometimes. It depends on whether we have time.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, a lot of times when they do get EVPs, they will ask the client, what does this sound like to you? Because they want to see if they come up with, they can hear the same thing they do.
Yeah,
right. And that's the way to do it. You don't sit there and say, doesn't this sound like it's saying, I'm
exactly.
going to kill you?
Exactly.
You know, you want to say, what does that sound like to you? Wow.
Exactly. And in the case of, like, I was just mentioning these EVPs that we've been milking for the last 4 years, and we literally have been milking these pieces of evidence.
We drag them out for anybody.
Yeah, and I've done that every single time with people, as I've said, give us a listen, tell me what you hear. That's all I say, you know, or maybe I shouldn't even say that, huh, Jeff? I mean, that's just a slight bit of fun.
Yeah,
you hear anything unusual here.
Yeah, just listen to this. What do you hear?
Right.
how generic do you want to get with it? But, you know, and a lot of times in this case, you know, we do hear a lot. We confer. They give us the same answers that we got 4 years ago on these things.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only been a handful of EVPs that I've heard since then that really have that clarity. I mean, I have stacks of EVPs, and I say that with big quotes right now as I'm talking, is that, you know, I've got tons of stuff I've clipped out that I've heard that I hear things, just things like help me or some weird thing. But it could, you know, really, at the end of the day, I think a lot of it is just the environment, sounds in the room, sounds outside, you know, all types of things that are happening. So, you know, I'm just kind of concerned about the whole matrixing thing. I can't say the word matrixing now, Doug. Help.
Good job.
Matrixing.
That's right. You have a point. Since we don't understand what process a disembodied energy would use to create the sound, it's hard to really know, because you're kind of like flying blind.
Yeah.
You've got this evidence here. You've got this voice. You don't know how they produced it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't really make a good critical decision about it. That's why you can't really prove these things, because you don't really know what you're trying to prove.
Exactly.
You're collecting information. You're saying, oh, this is something interesting. What is it? I don't know. How does it make it? I don't know.
Which takes us right back to, why are people getting sick? I mean, because we don't know. I mean, it took a lot of work to figure out why people were getting sick.
Right.
Why do people experience these things, right? And that's the problem I think we have. I mean, don't get me wrong. I still love going out and taking pictures and doing audio and exploring these cool places that are reported to be haunted. But really when it comes down to it, there is this issue where, okay, we don't even really know. There's lots of theories, but we don't really know. There's nothing been proven hand over fist like a Microsoft could. Freudian slip. Microscope could prove, that there's evidence, like hand over fist evidence in that case. So that's where I'm like getting. I mean, that's. I'm going to keep trying.
Me too. I think it's fun.
Yeah.
That at some point we may get to the technology together where we might really be able to have an interactive conversation with these entities.
Yeah.
And at that point, I think that would pretty well prove it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And I mean, I'm with you on that, too. I don't want to touch on this for very long, but, you know, I can just mention that, you know, the Spiritcom device. I'm sure you've heard of that before, Jeff, right?
Right.
And there was, I mean, this is back in the late 70s, early 80s when that thing was created. And I know there's a lot going on with this, let's just say. But the things that I have my suspicions of with that is that, I mean, which I told you, Doug, I mean, the first time I heard about Spiritcom was Halloween night of 2005.
Right.
Because I was at home listening to Coast AM. And I thought to myself, like, okay, this is like 25 years later, you know, and this is supposed to be like, the, you know, like this is proof that you can have two-way communication with, you know, with the dead, with people in the other, you know, wherever they're at, right? I mean, why don't we have these things on the shelf at your local store, like the you know, like an iPod or something now, right? Mm-hmm. It seems as, you know, that there was something out there, you know, and maybe there will be something that comes along that, yeah, this is it, here's the proof, here's how it's made, here's how it's done. There's no doubt in my mind that, you know, anybody's mind that this is done. But things like Spiritcom, they've come and gone, it seems like, for some reason. And they seem to be two-way communication with the dead. But there's just a lot of speculation around that, I guess. So I guess that's what's pulling away from its validity. I mean, I don't know.
Well, the problem is that ghosts are rarely predictable. You can't make them do things on command.
Yeah.
You can have all the equipment set up and everything going for you, and they just won't participate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it so difficult to prove them. And, you know, that's the part of the science that falls apart, is that you can't gauge their reactions or their responses. You can't predict what they're going to do. And if you can't get them to do that, then you have no real way of proving their existence.
Exactly. And that right there, again, ties in with the why are people getting sick thing we talked, you know, you mentioned in the very beginning here, is that we have
right,
no way.
The only proof that we have, or idea that we can base it upon, is the evidence that we have collected, plus the literally thousands of years of stories and testimony that people have seen them or interacted with them or whatever.
Well, I think what it comes down to really is statistics. I mean, that really is what's going to, I mean, if that's going to answer any questions, and that's what people are doing now, which I think is phenomenal, is that they're taking this, I think Dr. Andrew Nichols was the one that mentioned that a while back when we had him on. He mentioned that, he's like, you know, I think people should be going at this thing now from more of a sociological approach, where, you know, let's start collecting all these stories. And then start drawing, you know, looking at these stories and seeing if they have any type of fabric that makes them, you know, that kind of connects them together as far as similarities, and then start developing some statistics off of that. That seems like that's where it's going to have to go if we want to get some real answers. I mean, it seems like any problem solving you do, from what I've seen, whether it be at work or at home, is trying to find a pattern somewhere with something.
Well, I think there are people who are working at the
end
of it. There are parapsychologists who are getting the statistics together, but they work very much in secret because they don't want to release anything until they've really got some solid data behind it. So as a result, it seems like nobody's really doing this, but in fact, I think there are people out there.
Well, as long as they stay off MySpace, I think they'll be fine.
Get off YouTube and MySpace.
They stay off the web, you know, and not, like, start up a MySpace page and start blogging about it. They're going to be okay, you know?
I computed the chi-square of 6,000.
Nobody there would get it. And
like,
what?
Huh?
What do you mean, you liar? Oh, you're not Jason and Grant? Forget it. You know, whatever. I mean, really.
Who are you then?
No, but I do see what you're saying, though, Jeff, is that, you know, a lot of people, and I think there are, that's an interesting thought, is how many people are actually out there doing some really heavy
work.
I have a feeling,
Jeff, that there's a lot of people doing some interesting work. That they're not running around on the web bragging about.
No, they're doing it on their own because they don't want to have
issues. It on their own until they either come up with something or not. And there's a lot of really interesting work going on, I think, but we're not going to hear about it until either a conclusion is made.
Or they come on Ghostly Talk.
Or they write a book.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there's a lot of credentials on the line, too. I've talked to people who are scientists about, you know, on different subjects. And when you bring up things like the paranormal, UFOs, things like that, a lot of times they're very open to the idea, but they won't go on public record about it.
Well, yeah, that's a clear thing for a lot of people. I know we've talked to people, I mean, a lot of people, like at conferences and stuff like that, and they're like, you know, okay, I'm going to give you my phone number, but you don't give this to anybody else. And if anybody asked you that we had this, I mean, not like CIA stuff, like I'm going to kill you if you tell anybody, but they're like, look, just I want to discuss this. I want to, you know, give you my ideas, but I kind of want to keep it on the down low because I do have a career, and if this got out, they'd think I was some kind of weirdo and fire me, you know, which is really unfortunate nowadays that that has to happen.
That's true, too. A lot of times that is the case. You won't get peer-reviewed. then, you know, you have nowhere to go in your career. I'm always very I admire very much the people who will actually go out there on a limb. There's a couple of people, for example, who are looking for Bigfoot. They're actually anthropologists or primatologists.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they'll actually go public with it and be on TV shows and Discovery Channel shows and stuff and talk about it is amazing to me.
Well, yeah.
Well, so much at risk.
Well, that's like there's a very, very down-to-earth fellow who is a historian. He really is a historian in the state of Michigan, more a maritime historian. And he does, like, very serious, dry history, you know, like what you're used to, you know, and
pretty much,
just goes on and on. But what happened is he noticed over the years that he started, you know, hearing from, because when you're studying history, sometimes you have to go and talk to some people who remember.
Yeah.
So you're sitting there talking to an old salt or whatever from the Great Lakes region, and he'll suddenly spill out with a ghost story or something like that. So he kept these. He wrote these down, but he didn't think anything of them. And eventually, and I'm talking, you know, many, many, many years of studying, you know, dozens of years of studying history. And then he's like, I'm going to put these in a book. These are kind of entertaining, you know. Now he's got, what, 4 or 5 books out? That's Frederick Stonehouse, you know, Great Lakes Ghost Stories, who, by the way, has not answered any of my emails. But,
come on, Frederick, give us a break, man.
But he's a historian, you know, and he just happened to collect these stories. And, you know, according to his little bio, it never had occurred to him that that he was ever going to write any kind of book like this. And it could easily, now let's say, for example, he's up to write, you know, because evidently if you need a historian, you it goes through some process in Lansing. I didn't get all that stuff, but you can bid for, you know, whatever. Anyway, so
I want that story.
Yeah, and so, but he, you know, he may actually not be taken seriously by other historians if they happen to run across this.
Yeah.
But, so he was taking a chance, but he's like, he made the case for it. He's like, I heard these stories. I don't know if they're true or not, but I heard these stories. They're historical, you know. They talk about ships that sank. They talk about, you know, different things. So, you know, I'm putting it out there. It may or may not be true.
Yeah.
So, and I admire that. I think that's fantastic.
And a lot of times other historians might publicly disavow it, but privately, if they talk to the guy, they'd probably be very interested in the stories.
Or they may even have heard some of their own digging through all the stuff, you know? I mean, because there's a lot of stories that, you know, that they'll run across, you know, digging into history.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Well, again, it's
there is the public view or whatever.
Well, you know, and it's from a hobbyist level, though, too. A lot of historian-type people, it's a hobby for them also. I mean, I think what Jeff, you were referring to, and kind of what I hit on, too, is just professional people who are physicists during the day, who are professors during the day. They would really, you know, if they were to, like, find out, yeah, this is my hobby, this is what I do.
Well, Stonehouse is a historian. He's not also a historian and mill worker or something.
He's a professional historian.
Yeah, he is a historian.
Okay, well.
Or an historian.
But I do admire.
He's like a living doing that, huh?
Yeah, I would be bored to death.
Well, he's probably a teacher or something. I don't know. That's all he can really do.
Well, no, when.
It's like being a DJ. Like, what do you do with this career? No,
there's nowhere to go but up. Oh, God. That was so insensitive of me. But anyway, what were we talking about before?
Well, we were just... we kind of got
I totally
point. Lost. Here's an idea. I think this is a good this is a good opportunity for us to take a break, I think. So why don't we do that?
It's hard to stay objective about ghosts. That's all I got to say.
True.
Yeah.
Because that's what we started talking about, objectivity.
Yeah. Why don't we take a quick break here? This is Ghostly Talk. I'm Scott.
And I'm Doug.
And we're talking with Jeff Allen Danilek. We'll be right back after this. And we're back.
Oh, yes, we're having a lot of fun in the
studio.
Yeah,
we're having a lot of fun.
Whee! We're talking to Jeff Allen Danilek, author of Reconsidering Atlantis,
mm-hmm.
Author of The Case for Ghosts, and I hear there's even more coming.
Yeah, do we want to get...
What else are you
Yeah,
doing?
What's going on here, Jeff?
Well, coming out next month is an objective look at UFOs, you know, kind of the pros and cons. Why are they here? Why would an alien race come here? How do they remain invisible to us? Why do they abduct people? Do they do cross circles? All that kind of stuff. So I think people might enjoy that. That's going to be really, I think, a big thing next summer for some reason. I just have kind of a feeling.
Well, that's quite topical because coming up in the next hour, we're talking to Bill Konkoleski, who's the Michigan State chapter president of MUFON, actually.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah. So
yeah, MUFON's located here out of Denver. It's headquartered here.
Oh, really?
Yes,
yeah. Bill, he's a...
We don't know anybody that high up.
No, we're not,
yeah. We know Bill.
So yeah, we know Bill. He's pretty high up, so we're lucky
yes,
to have...
Yes, he is. Mr.
No, he's a really cool guy. We got to meet him not too long ago, and he's a really cool guy. So this is an objective look, like you said, at the UFO phenomenon, then.
Mm-hmm. That's what it is.
And there's plenty of objectivity there, too, I think. I mean, you could probably, you know... See, it's something I think we're moving into more now is studying the UFO stuff.
Well, we've been talking to more and more people
more
about it.
More and more people about it.
Well,
yeah.
You know, it's 2012, fast approaches. We're going to have to learn about it.
Yeah, because when they come and take us all, we'll have to.
According to some theories.
We better get to know them a little
that
bit.
That only can be tested by time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that reminds me, I've also got a book coming out next September on 2012 and prophecies in general.
I want to get you on then next September.
I think that's coming out next September.
Well, when we're to celebrate the launch of that book, we want to talk to you about that because that's something I've always been interested in. So,
well, you know, you know, we're getting ready to cross over another year here. We're like, as in a couple of short weeks, we're gonna be in 2009, right?
Right.
So we're like literally 3 years away from D-Day.
2012.
Yeah, whatever you want to call it, 2012. And you know, it's cool that you're writing something. Excuse me, writing something on that too. I mean, high level though. I don't want to spoil the book. I don't know how we're gonna do that.
Well, all the...
I'm just wondering what you're...
I get to tell you all the prophecies are all doom and gloom, pretty much, followed by happiness or something. I don't remember, but it's just well, not good.
What was that, Jeff?
I look at the whole history of prophecy, doomsday prophecies in general, all the way back in, you know, hundreds of years ago. You know, those have been around for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at the psychology of them a little bit, and also I look at things, you know, what really... is dangerous out there, what really isn't. People, for some reason, they're just fixated by doomsday. And I'm hoping that maybe in reading this that people will have a little bit more rational approach to it and say, you know, bad things might happen, but probably not.
Well, something
well, we had a wonderful mini doomsday in, you know, 2000. For, you know, from 1999 to 2000, that everybody was ready for the worst. You know?
Oh, yeah. There was a Y2K bug thing.
Oh, yeah. Hospital equipment was going to fail, and
your
car wouldn't go, and food won't grow. And, you know, I mean.
And I looked out the window, and it was like just chirp, 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 chirp. Everything was, you know. And that was really, you know, that was really creepy because, you know, what I found kind of cool is, I mean, I remember it was New Year's Eve, 1999. And, I mean, I was actually, that's when I had my first apartment, and I was like, just, it was, you know, obviously, here in Michigan, it was ice cold outside, so I'm in the cozy, warm apartment, cleaning the apartment, getting all my stuff done, and I was watching the TV, and it was kind of cool, I was watching, like, you know, New Year's start in all the different countries, because,
right.
I mean, I don't know how the hell time works, but...
Yeah, they started the other side of the...
Yeah, it's New Year's there, but it's not New Year's here, and it was really festive and fun, and I'm like, well, we're all going to die in a couple hours, I mean, but I thought that was weird, too, because I'm like, well, it's New Year's there... And they're alive. As a matter of fact, they're
you
partying there.
He could have, like, turned the lights off just at midnight and really got you going there.
Well, they're partying. They're partying, though. They're having a good time over the other side of the world. So, and then, you know, like I said, it came and went for us, too, that night. And no one died. I didn't really hear of any
There was,
it was pretty mellow.
Very,
here
very
in Michigan.
Minor things that they just, you know, okay, that didn't work, so shut it down. But any critical system had already been patched.
Yeah, you know, so people are still drinking bottled water from New Year's, you know, and stuff like that, I'm sure. But, yeah, I'm really thinking it's going to, I mean, a lot of the same stuff, I mean, hey, quote me on this, whatever. I'm really thinking that 2012 is going to come and go. You know, a couple people are going to self-immolate themselves. Oh, we're all going to die, and they shoot themselves. Well, good job, buddy.
Well, we didn't, but you did.
You did, yeah, so I think it's
going
to come
and go.
Well,
then he'll appear in the case for ghosts in the next book.
It all comes together at the end.
Yeah,
yeah, you see,
all
makes
related.
Sense.
I want to, you know, I said this now twice, reconsidering Atlantis, you know, a new look at a prehistoric civilization. Well, here's the thing about Atlantis, and then of course, the mystery of reincarnation.
Yeah.
Well, okay, Atlantis, reincarnation, this is two topics that are prime topics that were discussed by Edgar Cayce, who, by the way, is somebody who I really, really, really dig.
You don't say.
And, no, really. I swear. And both Atlantis and reincarnation, he started talking about in his, like, little sleep things where he would give these readings, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what brought you into the topic? I know these are these older books?
Well, the reincarnation book was my first one. It came out, I think, 2003 or 4.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that led to the ghost book, and then the Atlantis book came along. So they weren't really related to Edgar Cayce. Oh, by the way, I talk about him in my prophecy book.
Oh, wow.
But to go back to your point, he kind of started the idea, but he really did influence me that much. These were kind of my own little explorations I was doing when I was kind of looking around for something to believe in, coming out of 20 years of being an evangelical Christian.
Ah, yes.
And so I kind of went down this path and explored some of these different things and just kind of wanted to share with the universe what I had learned and see if it helped anybody else.
Well, it certainly does, but so you ran across Atlantis and reincarnation from what? Did you know, grandma tell you about them, or, you know...
When I was a teenager, I was into all that stuff, Bermuda Triangle and all that, so I was already kind of had a background knowledge of a lot of these things, but it wasn't until I got into my 40s that I thought, you know, maybe I could write, and so I started putting some of my own ideas together, and that's where a lot of this material comes from, but these are things that I've been aware of for quite a while. I haven't come across too much that is really shocking to me that I didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was interesting that Cayce believed in these things, even though he was himself a very strong Christian.
Right, and he didn't really believe in them. I mean, in his waking life, he thought they were entertaining. Eventually, he learned to trust this information that he got through, you know, sleeping. But at first, he was absolutely flabbergasted and against it, you know, because reincarnation and Christianity don't go hand in hand very well.
No.
But if you do the research, you find out that the Gnostic Christians were reincarnationists. And so it was an element of the early church that just sort of was kind of phased out. But I think the thing with Cayce, how he got into it, was he was trying to diagnose people's illnesses. And a lot of them had to do with past life traumas.
Right.
And that's how he sort of slid into it. He was never crazy about the idea of past lives, but he understood that it had some sort of a medicinal effect on people to talk about it. So
right. Because what it is because he was, you know, a healer. They call it the healing prophet, right?
Yeah.
And or sleeping prophet and for healing. And what he would do is he would, you know, somebody's entire outlook, right, on life, an entire attitude, entire everything, had to do with who they were before. So then he started, you know, doing more like these life readings instead of specific medical readings. And so that's how they got a lot of the Atlantis material and the reincarnation material. But it did start out with people who were being affected in their current life by things that happened in previous lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so, which of course was all news to him, because he's like, no, this is not the way it works. But, you know, then again, how could he, you know, I guess if you accept the fact that he could heal somebody by just going to sleep and talking about them, you might have to at least pay a little bit of attention to this other stuff that started coming out. And so he did, and evidently it helped people. But Atlantis, according to him, and I don't know about according to your information, but according to him, was a fantastic place. And specifically I want to talk about, because we're having a little bit of an energy crisis, you know, where, mm-hmm. where for some reason gas is really cheap, but everyone's still upset. Although, and so, what... Okay, if they used crystals for power, they had these big sun crystals or something, and they made the power go through the air and power. Now that sounds very sci-fi-ish. Is anybody else saying that kind of stuff happened, or was that pretty much just Edgar Cayce?
Well, I think there's a lot of New Age people kind of picked up off of Casey's theme with the crystals and all this sort of thing. My take on it is a little bit more pedestrian. I kind of see Plato's writings having to deal not with a specific real place, Atlantis being a real, genuine place that existed, but as a metaphor for a civilization that existed prior to our present civilization. In other words, like an Ice Age civilization.
Existed
across the face of Asia. My premise in my book is that if humanity arrived at a level of technology that it's at today and then destroyed itself, let's say 12,000 years ago, what evidence would there be left of it today?
Oh, exactly. I remember this.
Okay, so the thing is that you probably wouldn't have any evidence of it today. It would be all under the ocean, or it would be, you know, rotted away. So the idea is that maybe man has reached that pinnacle of success several times in the past, and each time, for some reason, destroyed himself and had to start over from scratch again.
And I remember this because I think you or somebody talking about similar theory said something that, you know, if you put something out in the middle of a field and then don't touch it for even 100 years, much, if not all of it, is going to just decay and be reclaimed, you know. So... But then you go thousands or tens of thousands. Yeah, it's reclaimed. You know, nature will have taken it.
Especially any man-made objects. You know, anything that we can create in a factory.
Right.
Doesn't have anywhere near shelf life as, say, rock, you know, something like that that would last for hundreds of thousands of years.
Right. And even rock is, of course, subject to erosion and
exactly.
other things. So, and evidently the, you know, the ice shelf, even though it's millions of years old, is also, you know, subjected to, you know, the whims and fancies of climate change. So,
well, what I point out in my book is that if you go back 12,000 years ago, during the height of the Pleistocene Ice Age, the water levels, the ocean levels, were about 400 feet lower than they are today.
Mm-hmm.
They do that, the entire Indonesia archipelago becomes one big continent about the size of Europe. So if you had a civilization, that would be a good place to put it. And then once the water levels went back up 400 feet, most of it was submerged. The South China Sea, all of that's only a couple hundred feet deep.
First by water, and then by the silt that covers it. And
yeah, exactly.
The,
yeah. So, I mean, we're not even close to having the technology to even see what's under there.
Right.
So I'm not at all surprised that we can't find it. But I just work. It's kind of a fun book that just kind of ask what if. How would it have really worked if there really was this modern civilization 12,000 years ago, and what might have destroyed it? And so it's just kind of it's one of those kind of books. I'm not trying to convince anybody. I'm just saying that, you know, it was just kind of a different way to think about it.
And which is fascinating, because it's kind of sad. Because you got to figure, okay, if things do go awry in 2012 or shortly thereafter, and doomsday is upon us, the folks, 20,000 years from now we're going to be in Atlantis to them.
Exactly. We would be someone else's Atlantis, someone else's mythology. You know, so that was my point, is that whenever you get to a certain level of technology, you get to the point where you have the ability to destroy yourself.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't get through that period without destroying yourself, you know, you can get to a point where you get, finally get enough enlightenment where you're no longer a threat to yourself. But until you get to that point, there's always that danger. And I believe that's happened before, and that's what Plato was alluding to in his writings. He made up Atlantis as this kind of a metaphor, but he was actually alluding to something that really had happened in the ancient history that was known even from his time.
How interesting. And there's absolutely nothing that you can think of that could be evidence of this that we could recover now? I mean,
well, not in terms of an artifact, but I do wonder why, if you look at the at Asia, the entire continent of Asia, mm-hmm. there's very little oil in Asia. The only, other than the Middle East, it's really almost no oil. It's almost like it's tapped out. And the question I ask in the book is, how do we know that 12,000 years ago they weren't using also petroleum, and they basically tapped out the petroleum that they had in Asia? And so all we're having today now is what we can find elsewhere. Because remember the North Sea oil fields that England has?
Right, yeah.
That was all under ice. You know, the Alaska, all of that was all under ice back then. So that was inaccessible. But 12,000 years ago, what if you had oil underneath, say, where Indonesia is today, which, by the way, is a oil exporting country, though very, very light amount
right.
of export.
Yeah.
So there is some oil in Asia, but why isn't there more of it? That's the question I ask in the book. You know, is it just never formed, or was it just tapped out? How would you know the difference?
Well, that's really interesting. I don't know what conditions oil forms under, other than I'm pretty sure it's not, you know, decaying dinosaur carcasses or whatever they tried to tell us.
Well, it's all
70s.
Part of that, but the thing is that that's consistent around the whole planet. And these geologists who are looking for oil, they know what they're looking for, and they'll
right.
go ahead and do their test drilling, and it comes up empty. And they have a pretty good reason to believe there should be oil there, based upon the strata layers and stuff. You know, they get down there into a test drill, and there's nothing there.
Interesting.
So the question is, where did it go? Why aren't they finding it? There should be all kinds of oil all over China and Indonesia and Australia and all these places.
So maybe it got used up in the last civilization.
Now, wait a minute. I saw There Will Be Blood.
Yeah.
I don't think you guys have seen it, though.
No, it doesn't
It's
sound
called
like my
Seepage.
Seepage?
Anybody out there that saw the film, you guys are going to hate my guts after I say this. Sometimes you have a big ocean of oil under your feet.
Yeah.
You can drill other holes in the ground and seep the oil over to your area. For example, if you have a piece of property that doesn't have any more oil on it, right, but you know the people next to you who own the oil, you can be a thief and steal the oil, from what I understand. So you can drill in the ground, pull the seepage, and then refill your hole and then pump the oil out. So...
Well, you know, that's how Kuwait got invaded by Iraq.
There you go.
They were drilling at a diagonal angle
yep.
into what
seepage.
Was thought to be an Iraqi foil field.
It has nothing to do with this conversation whatsoever, but hey, I just wanted to throw it in there.
And you asked if there was any evidence for Atlantis, and that's the best I can come up with right there.
Well,
so.
I think it's not bad. It's actually not bad. I mean, because, you know, 10,000-year-old evidence is kind of difficult to find.
Plus
the fact that mythology exists in so many different unrelated cultures. They all have a similar kind of flood mythology. And yet a lot of these cultures never interacted with each other. So the question is, why do they all have their own mythology, unless they're not all relating to a similar event perceived through different cultural lenses many, many generations later?
Do you think we'll ever have time travel and be able to go back and answer some of these questions? Or?
Yes.
You do? Because
I don't know. You asked the question.
Sure,
you know,
no problem.
I was really excited there for a second anyway. But
who knows? You know, and the question is, if you did do that, how would you mess things up? You know, if you could really go back in time.
Well, to create a paradox like that, you know somebody will do it.
Oh, someone's going to do it.
You know,
may already have happened. You know, maybe the history that you're remembering right now.
If somebody can't make Microsoft Windows work properly, I don't expect anybody to go and hop into some type of time traveling machine. And well, that's actually a dumb thing for me to say. That's very difficult.
I hope Microsoft doesn't write the OS for it.
That's all I'm saying.
It'll probably be a Mac that does it.
Oh my gosh, the blue screen of back in time.
Yeah, it'll be a Mac and we'll never have to update it ever again.
Oh, that'll be awesome.
On a DeLorean.
And it'll smile.
Exactly. Well,
insane.
Yeah.
So then it's totally unrelated to reincarnation. Mm-hmm. How do you think reincarnation works then?
Well, I believe that our soul generates multiple personalities into each incarnation to experience different aspects of existence. For example, you can't experience hunger or contentment unless you've had unhappiness and things like this. So
right.
God's way of sort of experiencing itself through us.
See, hunger, unhappiness, oil, they all make sense to me now.
Well, there's a lot of people who believe that... there's a lot of people out there today who are reincarnated Atlanteans.
Right. From 10,000 years ago.
That's where they get this environmentalism from.
Oh, okay. So they're all the hippies then.
Yeah, all the hippies and the vegans are all reincarnated.
They're all, yeah. That's me.
Except they drive an SUV. That's the only non-hippie.
My girlfriend's an Atlantean.
Very, very much
a
so,
hardcore
yeah.
Atlantean. I've had to inherit the goat's milk soap and the all-natural organic shampoos that I can't get my comb through my hair after I use it. But it's good for you and good for the environment. So, okay, I'll have to live with that.
I thought women were from Venus.
Not my woman.
She's from Atlantis.
She's from Atlantis.
Yes.
But no, this is your segment.
I don't even know where it went, but reincarnation. Yeah. Okay. Is it possible to have multiple personalities on the earth at the same time?
I believe so, because actually these other incarnations are not really you. They're actually more like siblings.
Mm-hmm.
So when you are remembering a past life, you're actually seeing the memories of a sibling that was generated by the same parent's soul through your own current filter.
Do you know your view on it is very similar to mine, because I do think that we're, you know, like when I die, for example, I'm whatever little bit of me is currently here in this body is going to go back to go home, essentially. They call it, you know, going home or whatever. Of course, they say it in a religious sense, but I'm saying it, and you're really going back to the rest of you.
Mm.
I think there's a part of me that exists outside of... what I currently can experience or be in touch with. And
yeah,
that's why I don't have memories from previous lives.
Right. Otherwise, you would just be reliving that same incarnation.
Exactly.
Everything. But it's kind of like all of these incarnations are like little laptop computers that are all networked into a mainframe.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the soul is collecting all that information taken from each little laptop. So as we die, the little laptops disappear, but the information that they acquired remains in the mainframe.
And I've heard that same idea that
mm-hmm.
we've heard that for a couple of times from people where, you know, the human body or our that encompasses our soul. Let's just, for discussion purposes, to say that it is it's a sensory. Obviously, our bodies are sensory furnaces. We have six senses that, well, while they may not be as sensitive as other creatures on this planet, they're pretty well tuned. Our eyes are pretty, you know, are very, very accurate. We can see things. I mean, according to us, they're good. You know, I mean, that's a whole different conversation. But I mean, what you're doing is you do every day when you get up and you go out there and do your thing, go to your job or whatever. You're taking in all these sensory type things, all this information, and you're you know, that's how you live every day, and that's kind of how you survive too. As in, fire don't touch, burn skin, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is how you survive. And I mean, that could be. I've heard people with the same idea where we do our lives, part of our lives is collecting all this information, and you know, we take that with us as we go on. And yeah, it gets fed into the big ethereal mainframe in the sky, I guess you could call it that. So that is an interesting idea as far, you know, involving the reincarnation thing, and you know, keep coming, and there's the idea why you keep coming back to you get it right and all that stuff. Or there's a million.
You're not really trying to get it right. What you're doing is actually just experiencing an infinite number of possibilities from an infinite number of perspectives. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you put 10 people into a rowboat and send them across the Atlantic, mm-hmm. and they get to the other side, all 10 of them are going to have perceived that experience very differently. You know, yeah. They have very different ideas of how, what to make of it. They all have a similar experience, but they all are going to see it differently. And that's kind of what's happening with the soul. So it doesn't matter how many times you incarnate, you know, into the same kind of situation. You're going to see it in a different way each time.
Yeah, exactly. Hence the Jerry Springer show there. Because nobody can seem to agree.
Never run out of guests.
Yeah, Jeff, unfortunately, I'm sure we could go on for days. This has been one of the... it's been a really long year here, and we've had a lot of fun. But this has been one of the most varied conversations I think I've had in a very long time.
I know.
Which is fantastic.
We ghosted it up for the first half hour.
But we've, like, bounced all over the place here. This is just
wild. Then Atlantis and reincarnation and... wow. I mean, just amazing stuff. And speaking of which, the books are, of course, The Case for Ghosts, An Objective Look at the Paranormal, Reconsidering Atlantis, and we look at a prehistoric civilization, and The Mystery of Reincarnation. So all of that, I'm sure, at www.ourcuriousworld.com.
And there's some other things coming up, like you said, September next year.
The UFOs.
Well, the UFO book, and don't forget the prophecy.
And then, of course, September. The 2012 and prophecy.
Yes, awesome.
Wow.
Well, Jeff, hang on the line for 1 second. Don't leave us. Wow. A lot of fun there. I'm fried. We got to keep going here?
Yes.
This is Ghostly Talk. I'm Scott L.
And I'm Doug.
We'll be right back after this.